Hi, this is Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We're talking on the Monday after the Oscars. We're talking the Monday after CPAC. And we're talking the Monday before Donald Trump's big address tomorrow night, Tuesday, to Congress. So we've got a lot to talk about. And we have as guests Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Nick.
And we also have a features reporter for Reason, Eric Boehm. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get right in with the Oscars. You know, one of the big thing here was, I guess there are two big issues as far as I'm concerned. One was the anticipation that there were going to be a lot of political speeches and a lot of anti-Trump kind of comings and goings, sayings and whatnot. And then the other was the big screw-up at the end of the evening, which says that however incompetent government is, private organizations often get things wrong, where La La Land was announced improperly or incorrectly by the thousand-year-old man, Warren Beatty, when actually Moonlight won. Eric, let me toss it to you first. What you know? Did you watch the Oscars awards, and what did you think of the spectacle of Hollywood telling us all how
yeah,
we should live?
I did watch. Actually, I thought it sort of moved along slowly as these award shows always do. I was pleasantly surprised by the lack of overt politics. A lot of jokes. I thought Jimmy Kimmel did a good job of treading the line between sort of mocking the elitism of the Hollywood crowd that he was surrounded with, and also getting in a few pretty appropriate jabs at the president, pretty obvious and easy jabs, I should say. The whole thing at the end, though, I mean, that's what everybody's going to be talking about. The mess up, Steve Harvey is off the hook, I guess, as the worst blunder at the end of a major award show now, right? Everybody will be talking about this Oscars next year, and probably, you know, as long as we're alive, as long as the Oscars are still going on, there will be jokes made every year about, oh, wait a minute, did they really win Best Picture, or are we going to get we're going to have to go to the booth and get a review on that the way this happened. Also have to mention just, you know, really terrifically well handled by the La La Land folks. I think they really did a great job when the whole sort of kerfluffle unfolded on stage. It was a spectacle, right? If the idea is to get people to tune in and watch the Oscars, I think they certainly will have accomplished that next year. This will be the thing everybody's talking about.
I do think that the La La Land people probably should have pirouetted off or done some kind of, snapping finger jazz number to gracefully exit the stage. Catherine, what did you think, particularly about the politics? You know, it's funny because I go back and forth. I actually love, and I say this both ironically and totally unironically, I love when people inappropriately inject politics into events like this. I find it distasteful when every single thing in American life gets politicized. But, you know, going back to Marlon Brando sending up Shasheen Littlefeather to reject his Oscar for playing Don Corleone in The Godfather, there's been a long string of kind of great moments that have been founded by politics being injected into the movies.
So I definitely love that we now have an official national beef between Meryl Streep and the President of the United States. I think that's like a glorious reality that we live in today. And I think, you know, Kimmel's joke about her being overrated and the standing ovation was quite good. In general, though, I think the politics were actually at exactly the wrong level. It was basically a reversion to let's be casually disdainful of Republicans, in this case, Donald Trump, acting as if the rest of America agrees with us completely and is in on the joke. But let's not be too overt about it. So I actually thought this was a sort of, I'm not going to go full this is why Trump won, but I do think it shows how quickly people go from total hysteria to back to their political baseline.
What did you guys think about the director who won for Best Foreign Language Picture? It was an Iranian picture called The Salesman, and he is a previous winner. He did not travel here, and it wasn't fully clear whether or not he would have been able to get in because he is an Iranian citizen and he travels on an Iranian passport, and I'm not exactly sure. You know, there was a moment just a few weeks ago where he would not have probably been allowed into the country. And he, in the note that was read on his behalf, it was I thought it was pretty interesting and pretty moving, where he talked not simply, he was not just saying, you know, Donald Trump is Hitler, and, you know, whereas the Ayatollahs and the theocracy in Iran is enlightened or anything. He actually talked more broadly about a rise of authoritarianism and a rise of extremism around the globe, and that we should push back against that. I actually found that a very I don't want to say balanced statement, because it was impassioned, but it seemed to me to hit almost all of the right notes. And I noticed kind of right-wing Twitter was like, oh my God, can you believe this guy? He lives in a country that stones gays to death, and he's lecturing America. And I didn't really take it that way. But did you guys have different reactions?
I actually really liked I thought his was the best version of Hollywood or movies or art done right, brings people together in a morally elevated way. Like, he basically said that, right? He said, you know, when you look through someone else's camera at a world that's different than your own, it generates empathy. And I thought that was the best case scenario for Hollywood self-aggrandizement as compared to the, you know, La La Land variant. But I'm a bit of a La La Land hater.
Well, what do you hate about La La Land? Because I don't even care what your particular complaint is, because I'm going to back you up 100%. But
okay,
let's hear.
Okay, that's good to know. I twofold. One, I love musicals, so the problem was not the musical cheesiness. If anything, I wanted them to go more all in on the musical cheesiness. The idea that, like, the epitome of struggle is trying to be a famous Hollywood person, I just couldn't quite get on board. Also, Emma Stone's voice sucks.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean,
credit for doing most of her own singing and dancing.
Well, I mean, on the large point, I think the only thing that is worse than movies that denounce television as the worst influence on everything in American life are movies that celebrate the magic of movie making and are kind of Valentines to Hollywood itself. I love, as somebody who could not carry a tune if you strapped it to my back and put me on roller skates, I loved who was it in Les Miserables, Russell Crowe croaking through things, and Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan was like a modern day Prometheus, stealing beauty from the heavens in Mamma Mia. I love non singers who just belt it out no matter what.
I think there's an argument to be made for, if, like, musicals are going to continue to be a thing, which they kind of are, right? Everybody pretended like La La Land was somehow this special throwback to a time that doesn't exist anymore in Hollywood, but Hollywood still makes these big picture musicals. I mean, you just mentioned one from a few years ago, Nick. I think put Broadway people in there, though. Put people in there who can sing.
Where is Idina Menzel when you need her?
Right, like Emma Stone can play so many other roles. She doesn't need to sing to be in a good movie. She could, and you know, she won Best Actress and deserved and all that, I'm sure.
She's
a very good
musical
actress.
Don't, you know, not if
you know,
she
let somebody
for a
else
musical
do the singing.
But maybe we could have swapped out with a little bit of special makeup effects. Janelle Monáe from Hidden Figures, put her in La La Land, and
sure,
throw Emma Stone,
yeah,
in the more dramatic role. Well, let's talk about another kind of hilarious political spectacle that unfolded in recent days, and that would be the Conservative Political Action Conference, Eric, or CPAC, the annual gathering of conservative activists. I mean, essentially, it's a Republican Party rally of a particular type of Republican for the most part. It unfolded over several days, and it was kind of capped by a long speech by Donald Trump in which he inveighed against the media for a good chunk of time, then talked about his program coming up, his policy program. Can you give us the general impressions? You've written about this at Reason.com, but what was your big takeaway from the event?
The big takeaway that I had was Donald Trump's speech, which I think, it wasn't so much a capper as it was sort of the midpoint. It was on Friday morning of this conference that took place at National Harbor, Maryland, over the weekend from Thursday through Saturday night. President Trump, of course, Donald Trump was there 2 years ago and spoke to the CPAC crowd to wild acclaim. And he even mentioned in his speech on Friday that it was really the reaction of the CPAC crowd that made him think more seriously about pursuing the presidency. And of course, we know how that turned out. Last year, though, a very different sort of tone there, where he didn't come. He actually canceled his appearance at the last second, There were concerns that there might be protests or walkouts because the CPAC crowd, as you well know, Nick, is a more conservative Republican crowd. It's sort of that Tea Party Christian right sort of mix that tends to be very prominently on display there. They had other favorites in the primaries. Donald Trump was not their guy. And then this year he's there now as president of the United States, which nobody a year ago probably could have predicted. Again, getting wild acclaim for things that for saying things and for pushing policies either in his speech at CPAC or in the last week or two of his administration that really aren't things that we would typically think of as conservative, or at least not things that you would think fit with that. For example, I mean, just 24 hours before he took the stage, less than 24 hours before he took the stage at CPAC, he was Sean Spicer mentioned that the Department of Justice might be cracking down on states that have legalized marijuana. And then sort of walk that back. So we don't know exactly what that policy is going to look like, but whether it's that or whether, you know, we were just talking about the Oscars and talking about the Iranian filmmaker Asghar Farhadi, who couldn't, who didn't show up last night, and maybe next year may not be allowed in the country. Who knows if he wins another Oscar? These sorts of things, this sort of crackdown on free trade, this crackdown on states' rights, these go right against some of the conservative principles that are supposed to be on display at CPAC.
But if Farhadi wins a third Oscar, then that will be a further diminution of Trump's power, because we're outsourcing foreign language, best picture Oscars to foreigners. But you're telling me there aren't foreigners living in America that we should be giving those awards to?
Obviously, Americans should be, he's taking American jobs away from Hollywood, I guess. One of the foreign language films was from Australia, which made me scratch my head for a few minutes. But then I realized it was actually in a different language. So I guess that's why it qualified.
Well, and also, I mean, in Mad Max, the original installment in the Road Warrior franchise, yeah, they actually dubbed Mel Gibson's voice into something that Americans would be able to understand. And I think we still need that today.
Can we get a Mel Gibson translator today? That'd be useful.
I think we have been hearing him loud and clear probably for at least a couple of instances where it would have been better if he had kind of garbled it up.
Maybe we need
a bunch of Paul Hoganisms.
Very true.
This question about whether or not Trump is conservative, and I agree with you, Eric. I think when you first of on the issue of pot, all of the Republicans, with a couple of exceptions, and you do hear people like Rand Paul, and increasingly people like Thomas Massie or Justin Amash, will be like, leave it to the states. It's clear that from a Quinnipiac poll, most Republicans, this most recent Quinnipiac poll, it was something like only 35% of self-defined or self-described Republicans believe in pot legalization, but 55% oppose the federal government doing anything against states that have legalized it for recreational or medical things. But the party has always been against. I mean, if there's a party that is anti-pot, it's certainly the Republican Party. By the same token, if states' rights is a way to possibly making life slightly more difficult for transgender, the five or six transgender kids in American public schools, they're all in favor of states' rights. Does it matter that, we're under this impression that the Republican Party is the conservative party. They're the party of limited government and of states' rights, of devolving power down, cutting government spending. They've never really done that, especially when they're in power. Sometimes they talk about it when they've got like five or six people left in Congress. So is this really, is Trump, one of the things that I think Trump is, he's like, what's his name, Hickey in The Iceman Comet, the O'Neill play, who comes to a bar where there's a bunch of drunks who are talking about all of their great dreams and aspirations. And he, throughout a 3-hour play, just systematically deconstructs their dreams and like makes them realize that they're never going to leave the bar. I mean, in a way, I think Trump is doing that to the Republican Party. It's like all you want is power. All you want is somebody who can lead. And you don't really give a shit what the policies
are.
He's
exactly that, right? I mean, yeah, he's an empty vessel that you can, sort of pour whatever you believe into him. And if you say something to him, he's likely to say that, yeah, he agrees with you. And that sort of seems to be his way of campaigning and now of governing. I think the other really interesting dynamic that was on display at CPAC this weekend, and Liz Nolan Brown, our colleague, wrote about this as well, and it's a piece worth reading at Reason.com, was sort of the way the alt-right kind of got rolled into the establishment in a way. I mean, I think what we're seeing, and she gets into this in more detail, but I think kind of what you're seeing here is that this sort of revolutionary alt-right wing of the party that you know, in some ways took over the Republican Party with the nomination of Donald Trump, it's now kind of getting folded in almost to the establishment, which is always what happens to revolutionaries, right? I mean, you end up sort of becoming the thing that you were revolting against. There was not the sort of wild discord that maybe some people expected at CPAC between the more traditional Republicans and this this more perhaps somewhat racist, somewhat nationalistic strain of the alt-right that that Trump has got a lot of support from. The Breitbart Party, for example, was as boring as any typical Republican gathering that you can imagine.
Weren't there belly dancers or something though?
It was a luau on a party boat, and it was originally supposed to actually leave the dock for a few hours, and there were going to be a lot of reporters who were going to be trapped apparently with Breitbart staffers for several hours. That didn't go over well, and so in the end they decided they were just going to keep the boat docked on the shore so people could come and go as they chose, and based on what I saw of it, it looked like most people chose just to stay away.
Well, that may become the hidden figure or the controlling metaphor for the Trump presidency. He just can't leave the dock, you know.
It just can't get away from the right, can't get away from shore, can't get away from the pull really of the Republican establishment, which still, you know, runs the show in a lot of ways.
Well, this is our kind of variation of the deep state, right? That Rince Priebus is always going to be calling all the shots, no matter what. So help us God.
God, you've just described literally my nightmare of last night.
There was, Catherine, possibly an even more important speech than Trump's speech was Steve Bannon gave remarks where he talked openly about economic nationalism as the goal of the Trump presidency. You know, how did that ring in your ears? And you were just coming back because you're a globe-trotting jet-setter. You just came back from a conference in Mexico City where you were talking with people. How does the turn towards economic nationalism, explicitly economic nationalism, America first, we're putting America first, and Trump is not slow to say, you know, and that means everybody is second, third, or fourth. I mean, he's like the father in The Legend of Ricky Bobby, where, you know, if you're not first, you're last, as far as Donald Trump is concerned, and Mexico and China, they can be last. North Korea, you know, even further behind in the pack, all of that, which makes a certain amount of sense. But how does the, you know, kind of exhortation of economic nationalism, how did it play to the people you were talking with in Mexico City?
You will be shocked to hear that it played poorly. No. So obviously, you know, people that I was talking to in Mexico City were kind of caught up in this, something very similar, I think, to the way the D.C. press corps is currently behaving, which is that every minute something new happens and it's even worse than the thing you thought could have happened. And they're just always in a kind of reactive mode. They don't even have the capacity to process stuff like what Steve Bannon is saying at CPAC, because the actual policy changes and the actual top-level diplomacy are still so dysfunctional and so uncertain. And that was the main thing that I heard, was just this incredibly large amount of uncertainty for people who do business with America and who are closely allied with the United States in so many ways. I was incredibly disheartened, along with many other people, to hear that we are now just saying the phrase economic nationalism as an official priority of the current president. I think in the last issue of the magazine, we said, okay, well, you know, Trump looks something like a corporate authoritarian or sort of a corporatist, because the word nationalism in some ways seemed too inflammatory. But now, of course, this word has been used at Breitbart for a long time, and that's where Steve Bannon is pulling it. But to say it as a kind of avatar of the president certainly is another escalation of this idea that you know, it's not just a kind of guiding spirit or something that we're leaning a little more toward, that it actually is the philosophy of the administration. I actually thought, though, more interesting was his claim that he was going to be working to destroy the administrative state, right? I think he said he wants, his goal is the destruction of the administrative state.
Which sounds pretty good, right? I mean, who doesn't want the destruction of the administrative state? I mean, he's talking particularly about the idea of all of these agencies, you know, which with unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats controlling more and more aspects of our everyday life, as well as the big picture. Shouldn't we be against the administrative state?
Right. Well, this is again kind of the Trump genius, which is that sounds a little bit like the thing that you know, Reason Magazine has been advocating, for instance, for many, many years. But then when you look closer, it's actually, you know, it can be read as almost something more like an opposition to rule of law or to predictability or to framework. So, yeah, like, of course, it is true that giant unwieldy bureaucracies are basically forces for evil. But in this case, I struggle to credit that this is coming from a genuine belief that limited government is good. And instead, it seems to be coming from a place of essentially revenge.
It seems to come from a place almost of suggesting that, like, the administrative state is going to get in our way. I mean, anything that the Trump administration has, I mean, they're sort of the systems that check presidential power in some ways are built into those administrative agencies, right? I mean, he's already had trouble with the National Park Service. He's had trouble, obviously, the courts is a slightly different thing. But I mean, you can see where there might just be an anger of, like, how dare you challenge our authority to just do whatever we want, or to have, you know, the confusion that existed when they implemented the immigration order at first between some of the different agencies, some of which apparently weren't even briefed on the immigration order before it went out the first time. So it's almost like a reaction against the unexpected unwieldiness of the federal government that I don't think Trump was prepared for.
It's also true when you look at right. So we have a new DNC head, Tom Perez, and I was reading up about him a little bit, and I found this quote from him from last year where he's being very explicit that he expects the toolbox of his agenda to be the administrative state. He said, you know, of his time as labor secretary, he said, everything is a workaround just about. I'm not waiting for functional Congress to do my job. The good news is I have ample tools in my toolbox to do my job. He said he would simply, quote, shore up workers' rights with the regulatory equivalent of duct tape and string. So it's not like Trump is fighting a boogeyman here. The explicit plan of the head of the DNC is to use the regulatory and administrative state to oppose the president.
Right. And actually, with Perez in particular, I mean, one of the things that came out of Obama's administration through the Labor Department was effectively a doubling of salaried kind of white-collar workers who are now covered under federal overtime regulations, where it used to be if you were a salaried employee and you were making at least, I think it was like $26,000 or $27,000, you were not covered by overtime legislation. They bumped that up to $47,000. And through an executive action or through administrative fiat, and that's being pulled back. So that's a place where we would want to see the administrative state kind of challenged. I want to say two things about the administrative state stuff. One is that I hate those ads from the National Park System. Somebody came up with the marketing cliche that the National Parks are America's greatest idea, and it's like, I mean, I think. And I don't expect you guys to agree with me on this, but it's like, really, fuck you. Like, that is not – the national parks are not America's greatest idea. And Teddy Roosevelt and many of the people involved in creating them wanted to have vast expanses of land where they could get away from smelly garlic-eating, you know, pope-worshipping, gefilte fish-eating, you know, Catholics and Jews in the early part of the 1900s. And so, like, fuck you. The national parks are used overwhelmingly by wealthy Americans. They're like libraries and all of these other things where and museums where, in the name of, you know, helping everybody, it just becomes a private redoubt for relatively privileged people. So I am very anti-National Park, and I say that as a Boy Scout, as an Eagle Scout who has slept over the course, who has camped out at least a full year in terms of nights over time. So I'm anti-National Park
system. Smack talk of Emma Stone is... My smack talk of Emma Stone is suddenly looking like the wimpiest statement in this podcast.
But then,
like, yeah, you know, yeah, what? No, also, I hate eagles. Yeah. No, you're right. You're totally right.
People were like, "Oh, right. Look at these renegade park rangers," you know, tweeting, you know, from official accounts. It's like, so fuck you. Like, why aren't you taking tickets? Why aren't you picking up litter? I don't, you know, I mean, like, or keeping your brim of your stupid Canadian Mountie hat, the campaign hat, flat. I mean, it's like, get out of here. Having said that, I do worry. I mean, I love the idea of getting rid of the administrative state, but it's not clear to me that Trump and Bannon want to get rid of. I mean, they definitely want to dismantle the current administrative state. But then you're looking at like, oh, but we also are going to implement the worst kind of worker identification rules that are going to affect everybody every day in America. And we're, you know, we don't want an administrative state, but we do want to have a complete lockdown of the border. And then immigration, when we allow it to be kicked up again, we're going to monitor who comes in, and you have to have this skill or that skill or this skin color, or this country of origin or that. So it's, and I guess this goes back to what you were saying, Catherine, is that if an attack on the administrative state is not proceeding from an explicit position of trying to limit the size, scope, and spending of government, you know, I think we're not getting rid of the administrative state. We're getting rid of one version of it, and what's going to be implemented next is something else. I mean, there was a New York Times story, which we can take with a grain of salt, about how, ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, you know, they're happy now because they feel like, you know, the handcuffs have been taken off of them and they can really start doing
put
their
on
job.
The Mexicans.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and that type of stuff is, we like to think, those of us who are, you know, privileged and are, you know, relatively white, affluent, who don't face this type of stuff on a regular basis, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's not that big a deal, but it's going to be a big deal. And I know, you know, from the first time you had to show your employer, or the first time it affected me, it came after the 1986 immigration reforms, but where you had to show proof of citizenship and or of legal status in order to sign up for a job and to get, you know, to do your job paperwork. I was a grad student at Temple. I was going to fill out my paperwork to get my monthly stipend. There was a massive line, and there were a bunch of obviously foreign students, people who were speaking different languages and, you know, looked like they came from someplace other than Central City or the main line in Philadelphia. They all had all of their paperwork in place, and literally every U.S. citizen had to go back home and come back, because all we had with us was our driver's license, because why would you ever think about carrying something else? And I think we're going to see that kind of requirement just beefed up, you know, put on steroids, and it's going to become uncomfortable in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump wants to get rid of the administrative state in D.C. and wants to kind of send it out into the country, right? I mean, we had a report already last week or over the weekend, maybe it was, of passengers on a flight from San Francisco to New York, I think, Nick, who were stopped as they were getting off the plane and asked to show their identification because it was suspected that there was an illegal immigrant on the plane and ICE was trying agency was trying to.
And it wasn't clear if it was an illegal, it was definitely a wanted person. But you did have this, and it was Customs and Borders agents did it. That odd thing of, you know, particularly on a ship's manifest, they know exactly who is on it. So you would think that they would have come on the plane and taken the person off. They would know the seat he was in, et cetera. And instead they, without explaining anything, they had an entire, you know, transcontinental flight have to show ID as they were exiting the plane, which is, you know, I suspect it has nothing to do with Donald Trump per se, but that kind of stuff. You know, you talk about normalizing things. We've already normalized our willingness to, you know, take off our shoes and our belts and empty our pockets every time we want to fly from, you know, Washington to Columbus, Ohio, to Dallas, to Chicago.
And that's what it sounds like the Trump administration's goal here is to beef up DHS, is to beef up border security, is to, you know, maybe we're moving the conversation ahead here a little bit, but supposedly he's going to announce a new huge increase in spending for the Pentagon. I mean, if you think that money is going to the troops, or, you know, this is somehow a support of the military, it's really not. I mean, what is the Pentagon? It's just one of the largest pieces of the administrative state in the federal government, right? I mean, this is just more money that will surely be wasted in some hole inside the Pentagon's budget. And so there's, you know, it's one thing to say you want to hack away at the administrative state. It's another thing to actually do it in a meaningful way, or to, you know, to see where that's shuffle around is where that's going to actually happen.
Well, this
is also, I mean, Jacob Sullum has been talking about this forever, the idea of fair weather federalism. And, you know, I think we're seeing that on glorious display here. Sometimes in the same speech, it's, you know, federalism at the beginning of the speech when it's something I like and centralization at the end of the speech when it's something I don't. And I think the administrative state terminology is really just another way of saying that. I like it when the government does what I like, and I don't like it when the government does what I don't like. And I will borrow the rhetoric of various consistent ideological positions when it suits me to make my case, but don't mistake that for consistency.
Yeah, and that goes right back to the origins of federalism. Years ago, we ran a wonderful book review by Charles Oliver, who writes our Brickbats, a longtime editor. Or contributor to Reason, and it was about how even in the thought of John C. Calhoun, who is often seen as the father of the doctrine of states' rights, he and most of the people in the slaveholding parts of the country were massive. They wanted a super strong federal government so that when their slaves escaped to free states, those states would be forced to bring them back, and they would have to respect slave laws. The minute that the South realized that it was losing federal power because of population shifts and expansion, they started promulgating states' rights. We saw this in the 2000 election, where the Republicans, who are typically strong proponents of states' rights, in Bush v. Gore, they immediately said, no, this is a federal issue. And the Democrats, of course, who think the federal government should be dominant, said, no, this is a Florida issue. There is only fair weather federalism, it seems, except for the libertarians. But I think that's because this is a different debate, but, you know, I think we want less government regulation of everyday life or all aspects of life at every level, state, local, and federal. Catherine, is there anything in Trump's speech that he's going to be giving to Congress on Tuesday night? Is there anything that he can say that would kind of warm your heart or make you be like, okay, no, well, you know, and it's an interesting question. And Brian Dougherty has written about this. I have a number of people have at Reason, and I know we have an ongoing conversation about this. You know, in terms of actual policies, Trump is going to be a mixed bag. And, you know, when I look at the people he's talking about to lead the FDA, he's got a couple of transhumanists in the mix who are going to relax drug control regulation, which I think would be really great. He's going to be good on school choice, it looks like. There are a number of things, that he could be good on. But is there anything that he can do that would make it be like, okay, you know what, maybe it's not going to be so bad?
There are plenty of things within his potential ambit, within the sort of universe of things that he said during the campaign that he could focus on in the speech that would sound good to me, including the things that you listed. But I think his actions so far as president, the executive orders that he's issued, the priorities that he has made clear in his appointments, none of that is looking particularly my heart is not warmed by any of it, to use your phrase. And I think the idea that, of course, embedded within the very large laundry list of things that Trump has said he might do, there are things that I like. But if he's going to continue to focus on restricting the free movement of people and goods across borders, then none of that looks too good to me. And I think the idea that he is he's almost certainly going to talk about Obamacare. He's going to say he's repealing it. He's going to say he's already repealed it. Who knows? But I certainly am not. I do not have the sense that there's a thoughtful replacement policy going into effect. And if the immigration order, if the travel ban is any model, we could be in for a lot more chaos on that front. I like some of his appointments. I would be happy to hear that he's got additional nominees, in his back pocket that he might want to throw out there. But, as long as we're looking down the barrel of, seven forbidden countries and Jeff Sessions and God knows what other manifestations of economic nationalism. I'm not too optimistic.
Eric, you write a lot about regulation as well as kind of bad spending policies and corporate cronyism at the state level. Do you think Trump is going to have any effect on any of that kind of stuff? Because he is anti-regulation, anti-business regulation, and a lot of that actually sounds good. We've been conditioned to think that somehow regulations serve the purpose that their stated purpose. Most of the time, they're not that effective, and they just muffle economic activity. But do you think Trump is going to deliver anything good on getting rid of cronyism or cutting regulations?
Getting rid of cronyism, probably no. I mean, he seems like he's basically a crony capitalist himself. He doesn't seem to have any problem with that sort of behavior. In fact, the whole economic nationalism thing really just seems like a nice way of saying crony capitalism. On the regulatory thing, I think that's probably the one area where libertarians can find some common ground with Trump, and that requires setting aside lots of awfulness, so it may not even be worth it in the long run. But he's been pretty consistent about wanting to cut back on the regulatory burden across the federal government, really, in every department. And I think his picks so far in places like in labor, in the guy that he picked to Ajit Pai, right, to run the to FCC. I mean, that's certainly a positive selection there in terms of regulatory reform. And I think as a business person and with lots of business people who are close to him and are in the administration now, I mean, that's one area where you'll certainly see things. What I'm most curious about, though, for Tuesday night is really whether we're going to get an actual policy-focused speech out of Trump. I mean, the State of the Union is the ultimate policy-focused speech. This isn't an official State of the Union, right? But it's basically a State of the Union. Or is this going to be much like his address at CPAC and every other public appearance he's made since being inaugurated? Is it going to be yet another recap of how the media didn't believe he could win, the pollsters didn't believe he could win, no one out there except his fans believed he could win, but Crooked Hillary was so terrible that he ended up beating her in November, and now he's the president and everything is great because he won the game? And if it's that, that's going to get old. I mean, it's already got old, I think, for anybody who pays attention. But that really is not what anybody wants to hear on Tuesday night. And if it's going to be that, I would rather hear Paul Ryan speak or something like that. Somebody who's actually in the nuts and bolts of the Obamacare issue, for example.
Well, with Trump, every day is Festivus, but the only part he likes is the airing of the grievances, it seems. Because the first half is constantly that.
Feats of strength on the floor of the House chamber could be fun to watch.
I would love to see that, especially, now that many of the older guys are out, you get rid of Harry Reid, anything could happen. What about the Democrats? Catherine, you had mentioned Tom Perez, who was elected as head of the Democratic National Committee, which is responsible for fundraising mostly, but also setting a kind of general agenda for a party. He's a big fan of the administrative state. Are the Democrats? Well, I guess there are two questions here. One is, are the Democrats actually going to put up a good fight by either unifying or coming up with a program that actually counters Trump, as opposed to, strangely seems kind of on a somewhat parallel track with him? And more than that, is it good, like, as libertarians, I don't think that any of us on this podcast really care about the electoral success of Republicans or Democrats as such. What we want are a set of policies, a set of attitudes, mindsets, temperaments that lead us to having less government in our lives so that we are more free to pursue happiness and, however we see it, and economically, culturally, in our personal lives. Do you think the Democrats are up to this, or are we witnessing kind of the collapse of the two parties into this kind of weird amalgam of, just kind of protectionism and Budinskyism? And then we've got to be looking for what comes next.
I do think Democrats are still reeling. It's sort of very easy to say Donald Trump is, the human incarnation of Satan, which was where they were shortly after the election. That does not yield a productive policy platform. I see actually a lot of parallels between sort of mainstream Democratic strategists and intellectual conservatives who are acting very little, who simply aren't doing much right now because they're not quite sure what they're reacting against. And I think, you know, I had predicted, and it looks maybe falsely, like that Trump was going to do a couple of things to undercut the partisan division further. I thought it was possible that he would come into office and sort of do a child tax credit and a couple of other things that had been on Democrats' wish lists for a while. He's not doing that right now, but I think if he did, it could throw them into even further disarray.
If he does expanded child care and paid maternity leave, things that Ivanka Trump was talking about. Yeah.
Which he really campaigned on explicitly, saying that he was going to do those things. You know, I could again, it looks like he's not going this way on the war on drugs, but he could have gone the other way because.
And the same thing with the transgender stuff. I mean, he was pretty explicit, like he doesn't really care about that kind of stuff during the campaign.
Right. So I think in some ways the Democrats' best hope is if he regresses to the Republican mean, which he sort of looks like he's doing, in which case they can stick with their old playbook, because I do think Trump over Hillary was such a fluky personality-driven election that it's not necessarily true. The Democrats should read that the coalition that they've put together can't withstand future election cycles.
Well, I think we are going to leave it there. I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
And Eric Boehm, features reporter for Reason. What are you working on these days, Eric, that people should be excited about?
A big piece coming probably in the next few weeks about transportation policy and Trump. We didn't get into that here, but we'll probably hear something about this on Tuesday night. You know, his promise to have a $1 trillion infrastructure stimulus of some sort and sort of debunking some of the commonly assumed lies about how that sort of thing works.
Well, I've got a gigantic pothole in front of my house in Ohio. And
we'll get right on
that. Yeah, it's a shovel-ready project if there ever
was
one. So, well, thank you, Eric, for joining us as well. I am Nick Gillespie, and this has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks again.